From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. corporate icons like McDonald's, Starbucks, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi are under fire overseas, targets of anti-American sentiment fueled by the war in Iraq. Suddenly, the great global market doesn't look so friendly. Security concerns gum the wheels of commerce, and the economic impact of soaring defense spending remains unclear. Tonight, On Point, war and the fallout for American business. We begin with the latest developments in Iraq. American-led forces renamed Baghdad's international airport today and continued to close on the city. Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked him for the big-picture status of the conflict.
It's on time, and it's going to plan. Now, obviously, this has been a difficult phase, getting to Baghdad, but I think the next couple of weeks, certainly, is probably going to be very difficult. Coalition troops have to surround Baghdad. They have to cut off the exit routes, the access routes, stop the bad guys getting in and out. And they have to work out a policy for Baghdad and how they actually deal with Baghdad in the longer term. And the one thing for certain is that we cannot have large numbers of civilian casualties and we can't have large numbers of coalition casualties. That would impact on public opinion in the US and the UK. And this is something I'm sure that the generals on the ground are keenly aware of, and they're under pressure from the politicians to do this softly, softly. And that's, I'm sure, what we're going to see over the next few weeks.
At this point, the Iraqi standing military looks so completely overmatched by U.S. forces. Is it still possible that some element of the Republican Guard or Special Republican Guard might stand and give a fight worth the name?
Well, certainly they're not going to stand in the open areas. If they try it in the open areas, they're destroyed almost instantly. And they know that. And one of the things we've been watching very, very carefully is the way in which they have never actually stood against the coalition, by and large, in open combat, in open areas where they can really be destroyed by air power. Now, there's a lot of Iraqi army and Republican Guard left. At the moment, the best count we have on prisoners is about 8,000. And, of course, before this war began, we were counting up somewhere around about 400,000 in both the Army and the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard. Now, there will be a lot of deserters and a lot of people have gone home. But that still leaves probably quite a large hardcore, and they're probably in Baghdad at the moment. Now, no one knows for certain, but I think we have to work here on a worst-case scenario. A lot of heavily armed, reasonably well-trained people inside Baghdad.
What does the example of Basra tell us about what may be ahead in Baghdad?
Well, I think the best way to describe Basra is a tightening of the noose. I spoke to someone in Basra on the edge of that noose about 30 minutes ago, and he said it continues to be a really slow, methodical job. And basically, it's all about taking out the Ba'ath Party themselves and also trying to wear down the military forces inside Basra.
And how exactly is that being done?
Basically, you take an urban area and you target an urban area. And you get as much intelligence about that urban area as you possibly can, and then you raid into that area. This is what they're doing at the moment. So they conduct a series of raids, and they take out, say, the Ba'ath Party headquarters. They learn about the activists in the area, and they raid in and out and take them out. And then they also go for any defended positions by Iraqi fedayeen or regular soldiers inside that area. And when they reckon that the opposition has been worn down to a reasonably acceptable level, they then conduct a large military operation into that suburb. So they've done it twice now in the last 8 days, and they've got basically two suburbs, and they've done that with minimal loss of life on both sides. So I think we're going to see that sort of policy, a policy something like that, being adopted in Baghdad.
Perhaps the same model. What about air power? Is the main role of air power now passed in this campaign? It was critical in the approach to Baghdad. What about in the next phase?
One of the wonderful things about air power, it's so flexible. Quite obviously, we're not going to see probably aircraft ranging all over Iraq, finding target after target. But air power in reserve, if there is a big job to be done, and maybe there will be a big job to be done in central Baghdad. That may be where the last redoubt of the Republican Guard is. And, of course, that's not an area where there is a large urban population. It's a pretty open area, mainly with government offices and things like this. And there may be a big role for air power in central Baghdad. Right at this stage, the great thing about air power is it's ready for anything. It can do almost anything it's called to do.
The Iraqi information minister said today that Iraq would use unconventional tactics to fight advancing forces in Baghdad. Do you see anything up Baghdad's sleeve that could change the balance of momentum or power here?
Obviously, when we heard that, we were very, very worried that he meant chemical weapons or biological weapons. When we got the full transcript, we realized that he wasn't saying that.
In fact, he specifically said not chemical or biological in response to a question.
Yeah, and we think he's really talking about some sort of guerrilla-type partisan attack. He did mention something along the lines of the Vietnamese fashion. They may be thinking of using suicide bombers or something like that. But really, we need to get through tonight and tomorrow and just see what he means. And it may just be bluster. There may be nothing much else for him to say.
I think a lot of Americans will go into this weekend feeling as though, given the great surge of the last few days, that the back of this war is broken. Would you describe it that way, Charles Heyman?
No, I wouldn't describe it that way. I think there has been a very successful opening phase to the war. We now have the Baghdad phase, and then I think after that we also have another phase of pacification of the country. All the towns in Iraq have got to be cleared of the Ba'ath Party, and a coalition military presence established in each one of the large towns. Now, that's going to take some time, and it's going to take a lot of people. We have to see how the future is going to pan out, whether we're going to be involved in some sort of guerrilla war or not. Now, my guess is that we're probably not. I think that once Baghdad's gone and pacification goes on apace, I think the enthusiasm for a guerrilla war will very, very quickly die away. I hope I'm right, but I think we're still going to be seeing quite a lot of coalition military activity for at least a couple of months yet.
Charles Heyman, thanks very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Charles Heyman is a retired major in the British Army and editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with me from Shrewsbury, England. War rages, nations seethe, and suddenly, once again, the 90s look like such a walk in the park. U.S. businessmen crisscrossing the globe as harbingers of innovation, borderless commerce, and deals to be done. Now, American brands draw stone throwers in an uncomfortable number of global locales, and global insecurity and war suck up energy and resources once aimed at bright new economic horizons. In this hour, we look at the impact of war and insecurity on American business. How much international business travel would you really like to be doing just now? Will war in Iraq bolster American business opportunities or further constrict the global economy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Millburn, New Jersey, is Michael Mandel, chief economist for Business Week magazine and author of How War Will Reshape the Economy, the cover story in Business Week's forthcoming issue. Good evening and welcome, Michael Mandel.
Good evening.
Hi, thanks for being back. Thanks for joining us. Michael Mandel, you've got such an interesting take on the economy and what's coming as a result of the war in the big article we've got our hands on here. But your top-level take is, as I understand it, something we know well, that stability and certainties are good for business and economies. Uncertainties are not. Do you see the war in Iraq as creating a more certain global environment and economy or less?
Well, let me just say, in the short run, what's going to happen is that the money that's being pumped in from the military spending in the short run is actually a plus for the economy. If you look at a little bit further, what happens is that we're clearly in a much more unsettled condition than we were in the 1990s, and that's a bad thing for innovation. It's a bad thing for growth. It's a bad thing for globalization. And all told, you know, the war and its aftermath is going to dampen growth.
dampen growth. Let's look at the most obvious thing first, the thing we've seen on television. It's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today or this week. Brands, American brands abroad, struggling to hold their footing and their popularity with foreign populations where there are now calls for boycott and a very strong anti-American sentiment. Let's just deal with that first. How big a problem is it for brands we see on the Internet, boycotts being mounted against, you know, Coca-Cola and Microsoft Windows, Gillette, Budweiser, Viagra, Kodak, Texaco, Pampers? Is it as simple as a world turning against American brands? How big a deal do you think this is, or is this just icing?
So far, that's not a big deal. So far, it's a lot more light than it is reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you sort of see is you see some calls for boycotts here, you see some vandalism there, but so far you're not seeing people just stopping to buying American brands. The bigger problems go beyond the boycott.
Mm-hmm.
into the connections between the U.S. and the rest of the world. How much people want to do business going forward, and really how much are people willing to sort of invest in the future when they're worried about war?
Let's take a look at what you predict, which is an immediate bump from wartime spending. You point out that defense spending in this fiscal year will account for 29% of GDP growth, almost as much as during the Vietnam War. That's huge. What do you see the likely immediate impact of that war spending and military spending being?
Well, think of putting a floor under U.S. economic growth. So what's going to happen is that the war is going to go on for another couple of months probably. And just as the war comes to the end, a lot of this spending is going to come online. So you're going to have a double bump from the end of the war and also the spending. And so if you look out into the second half of this year, you'll see that we're not going to go into another recession, that this will keep things from dropping too much further.
And this is spending to replenish the armory of the Defense Department.
It's more than just the armory. It's the hazardous duty pay that goes to the dependents of the soldiers.
All those soldiers.
All right. And it's all the supplies that are being bought. The cost to replace the missiles is actually a very small part of this. It's a lot of these other costs. It's the intangibles. It's the personnel costs and so forth. That's really the important stuff. But if you look at it a little bit further, what happens is we're looking at much more of a stagnant period coming up, a combination of the unemployment and the loss of jobs,
mm-hmm.
which we heard about today, continued job cuts, combined with the fact that it's a world where people are more scared.
You quote Joel Mocher at Northwestern University saying, war is the enemy of most useful innovation. We think of innovation in the last decade as the main engine of the American economy, perhaps always. What's the connection? Why the drag?
Well, what happens is that if you think about the last decade, what happens is innovation requires people being willing to take risks. It requires people willing to sort of say, you know, I care about the future. I think the future is going to happen. I'm going to invest in something new. What war makes people do is focus on security. People focus on security. People put up barriers. They worry more about protecting themselves than they do about moving forward into the future. And it's a very different mentality. What happens in war is that you get a lot more centralization, a lot more government control. That's bad for innovation. You get a lot more resources devoted to the military, into security guards, into the Army and the Navy, into the things that we need to protect ourselves rather than into productive investment. Now, the fact is we need to protect ourselves. We need to make those And we need to spend that on security because security is our top need, but it drains away money from other things.
So you say, Michael Mandel, the real threat to productivity growth is this unsettled, hostile world. We thought the war was supposed to settle that world, to make it more secure.
Oh, well, the war is a step in a larger picture. The reason why we're fighting this war is because the war is because you know, it's a little bit like you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
Is that the reason? We weren't exactly sure, but it's an omelet situation.
It's an omelet situation. And so the fact is that we're I think that we had to sort of mount some sort of action in Iraq, but that doesn't necessarily make us safer. Okay, it's something that we had to do. But the reverberations from it are going to keep going and going and going. And really what it is that the world itself feels unsafer.
In spite of the war. Michael Mundell, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about war and business, the impact on American companies abroad and here, and the economy all over. You can join the conversation. Is the world still safe, still welcoming for American enterprise? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about war and business, the impact on American companies abroad and the economy all over. You can join the conversation. Will the war clear the decks for new economic growth or sour the world on American deal makers? Is the war helping or hurting your business? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Michael Mundell. He's chief economist for Businessweek magazine and author of the cover story of the new Business Week coming out next week, How War Will Reshape the Economy, joining us from New Jersey tonight. We're also joined now from Washington, D.C. by Stephen Richter, publisher of The Globalist, an online magazine about the global economy. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Richter.
Good to be with you tonight.
Thanks for joining us. Stephen Richter, we hear an awful lot of stories lately about just practical issues around doing business in this less secure world, about companies pulling employees out of some far-flung locations, about American business people feeling insecure abroad, about the problems raised by not only war, but now this SARS disease in the Far East. Do you have reports of American business pulling in its horns in the face of insecurity issues around the war? Is it having a material impact on how Americans do business overseas?
It truly does, and unfortunately it's not just U.S. companies, but the same applies for any multinational corporation. Many of those are not headquartered in the United States. And we need to remember that the current spat of the war with Iraq is only the third step in a downward ladder that we've been on for some time. We've had the issue of terrorism, Al-Qaeda, that is impacting some key areas today like Indonesia and the Philippines. And we also have had the problem in the Asian region of the severe financial crisis in the late 1990s. Which also didn't help. So we've been going downhill for quite some time, and that really has a very negative impact on business sentiment and business planning. A very real question is with regard to the previous conversation with Michael about omelets and breaking eggs, whether that will really help us right now to improve business sentiment, because after all, what the world needs the most in order to get to peace is to have economic prosperity that can be shared around the globe. And I think there are many of those many business people around who question whether the focus, the singular focus of the Bush administration on Iraq really helps that or delays that. Let us also recall that when the administration started, there were very big questions about whether this administration really had sufficiently deep bench in the economic team. No question about the national security team. And, you know, way past the midway point of this administration, those doubts in the minds of most business people and business leaders that I talk with when they're talking openly have not been eradicated at all.
Stefan Richter, then you're actually raising questions here about whether the war will in fact have a kind of clarifying impact that would help the market, the economies of the world, of the U.S., find its feet again. But what about the stock market? It went up at the start of the war. It's gone up again recently as the war has gone well. Is that not a vote of confidence in the outcome or the impact of the war on the economy?
Anybody who pins his hopes or her hopes on the stock market as a clear-cut signal that we should follow with regard to guiding our future must not have lived through the last 5 years or the entire 1990s. I think what we really need to look at is what the conditions are to create global growth. GDP growth, growing the economies, growing jobs, and on that front, even in the United States, even though we have decent enough GDP growth, we are having not just a jobless recovery, which was a big topic last time around we went to war, around Iraq. We're not talking about it this much. Currently, we have certainly declines. You mentioned the declining job numbers as well. So, but if, from a business perspective, what I'm picking up is that, and I don't mean to be cynical about this, but that there are quite a few people out there, business leaders, who actually are not too peeved about this war happening now, because it distracts a lot from very negative attention being given to business, global accounting scandals, Enron, all these things, overhangs from the 1990s.
And a lot of ugly numbers being reported and gotten out of the way while all attention is fixed on Iraq.
Exactly. And I wonder, frankly, whether if Iraq right now is a convenient distraction that doesn't focus too much on business, once that's over, let's assume it goes as well as it could be. You know, the U.S. takes, the coalition takes Baghdad, and there won't be any Northern Ireland situation with
endless
terrorism
fighting
and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't talked to any business people who have told me that then they're going to start investing big time, certainly not in the U.S., certainly not in Europe. I mean, to the extent that people plan to invest, it's all about China, and that doesn't help workers in the United States. That doesn't necessarily help workers in Europe in terms of getting more jobs. It makes goods cheaper in our home markets through the imports, mostly. It's U.S. and European-based companies that produce and bring those things back.
Michael Mandel, let me ask you about that. You quote Larry Ellison, CEO of Oracle, saying, "It's a dangerous world. We had this amazing 10-year period when we pretended it wasn't." We hear Stefan Richter here saying, "We're just not creating an environment, a tone that's supportive of business."
Both of these things are true. Okay, let's think about what the 1990s was like. What happened is we had this great boom of growth, and everybody believed in growth,
mm-hmm.
and so there was a feedback effect. And now the problem is that we had a virtuous circle feeding on itself,
and this kind of frictionless world of ideas and innovation and a lot of business
and a lot of capital.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm worried about at this point, and the war is one contributing aspect to it, is that we're going to move into a situation where the virtuous cycle starts going in reverse. People that we have a period of slow growth, and people stop believing in growth and stop doing the things that are necessary to make it happen.
And I read you saying the war could push us into that gear. For example, very sharp tensions between old allies across the Atlantic could have an impact on trade talks.
Exactly. So this is what we're looking here, is that one strand of a negative picture on growth is a more hostile world, because people focus on security and they don't focus on growth, and rightfully so. But you have to sort of keep both of these things in your mind at the same time.
Stefan Richter, Michael Mandel, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Robert Hormats, joining us from East Hampton, New York tonight. He's vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International. Good evening and welcome, Robert Hormats.
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us again. Robert Hormats, we're looking at the economic table that's being laid by the war and everything surrounding it. The core of Michael Mandel's concern, and Stefan Richter to a great degree, is that we're looking at a world that just has more insecurity, more uncertainty, more potential bad things that people imagine could go on. How much of that do you lay at the feet of the war in Iraq, and how much has just tumbled out of the 90s with September 11th and the heightened terror threat and all the rest of it? How do you parse that?
Well, some of it certainly predated the war. I mean, we had this bubble period of very high expectations, and growth was really perpetuated by a strong stock market that made it easier to raise more capital, which created more growth, and we got a very big bubble. There was also a lot of debt that was accumulated at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So a number of the issues facing the economy predated the war. The war added another layer of uncertainties. The war plus terrorism created a level of uncertainty that many Americans had not perceived on a geopolitical level since the Cold War. And that, I think, added to the concerns that people had about taking risk. Not only were there economic reasons for not taking risk because of the collapse of the bubble, there were a whole host of geopolitical reasons. And my concern is, one, that even if the war goes very successfully, we will still confront all these other economic problems that predated the war, and two, the war won't erase all the geopolitical uncertainties. There's the geopolitical uncertainty of the occupation of Iraq, how long, how difficult, how expensive. There's still North Korea. There are still concerns about terrorism, and there are concerns about instability in other Islamic countries that could be triggered by the feelings that people have the United States shouldn't be in Iraq or shouldn't stay in Iraq. Or
what about that at a very practical level, that anti-American sentiment? We've seen a lot of it in the streets. Do you see it? I put the same question to you. I put to Stefan Richter. Do you see it affecting the way American business is done, the willingness of American, I don't know, American families to relocate, to run an oil refinery in Indonesia or to do business in the Middle East or even to be frequent travelers in Europe these days? Is there a new friction abroad in sentiment toward the U.S. that's having an impact on the day-to-day execution of business?
Well, there certainly is a new friction. How long it will last and how extensive it will be remains to be seen. Some of this could blow over. I suspect, however, that there was already pushback against globalization and against American and other multinational corporations even prior to the war, and I suspect the war is going to just exacerbate that problem. I don't think it will have an enormous effect with respect to these consumer boycotts that we're seeing, although it will affect some consumer goods companies. I do think that in some parts of the world, particularly Islamic areas, it may be more difficult for Americans to locate and more difficult for American companies to do business. The closer you are to the Middle East, I suspect the more difficult it will be. In East Asia, except for the Islamic countries, I suspect the impact won't be very great, nor in Latin America, nor in Africa. Mm.
We've got a great gang together looking at the economy and the war tonight. Michael Mandel, Stefan Richter, and Robert Hormats, you're welcome to join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is calling. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I basically have a question. Early on in the conversation, Michael mentioned something to the effect that war stifles innovation. And I just had a comment and was curious on his comments and your other guests. It's always been my understanding that war, in a way, I guess, is a creator of innovation.
A spur.
A spur to some degree. I can't name any specific products, but I'm aware of several just from my schooling of consumer products.
Radar from World War II and on the go.
Very few major innovations have come out of military efforts. What happens is that wars greatly accelerate in a couple of specific areas things that are needed for the military. But historically speaking, if you look at the broad mass of stuff that we use, that are the major innovations, very, very, very few of them have arrived either from the military or even sort of military spending. One of the few ones that may have is the Internet, which got some
DARPA funding early on.
But once you've taken that out, not microprocessors, not the telephone, not the automobile, you know, you can go down. Maybe the airplane you can attribute partly to
the Red Baron.
To defense spending, okay, but the great majority of the stuff that we care about is not military related. It actually, you know, when you go back and look, I know people sort of often think that a lot of the innovation comes out of defense spending in war, but it doesn't.
Eric, it's a great question, and I want to broaden it if I could, Michael Mandel. We take your point there, but you also point out how much more is going to be spent on security overall. 300,000 extra security guards, police, firemen, spending $10 billion a year. We hear a lot about technology being developed to heighten security. Stefan Richter, let me put it to you first. Do you see, is it possible that security and all the new emphasis on it could be a spur to growth, or is it a net loss to growth?
It's the same argument that Michael presented earlier. Short term may be good, but over the long term for productivity, the question is this a productive investment? Marginally, of course, if we feel more secure, it is. But the tendency in the United States in situations like that, as with the defense budget, is to overspend and, spend like there's no tomorrow, which is what we've seen with the defense budget. We are living in Washington in a world where, at a time of war, we pass out tax cuts. It's as if the dot-com mindlessness of spending money like there's no tomorrow has infected the .gov sector about 5 years too late. And I think all of these questions are going home to roost because we should not forget that 70% of the U.S. economy and most major economies is driven by consumers. And these are voters, and many of these voters will ask a simple question next year. With all the stimulus for war, as Michael has put it so well in his article, what has that done for us, Mr. President? What have we gotten out of it in terms of jobs and incomes?
But Michael Mandel is quoting James Paulson at Wells Capital Management in Minneapolis. saying we could see pretty sharp growth in the second half, 4% growth maybe.
Yes,
Robert Hormuz, let me put it to you. Do you see us heading into a darker world here, where apart from the excesses of the 90s, we're just up against more insecurity, more uncertainty, and a kind of perpetual slower growth as a result?
I think we will probably have relatively slow growth for the rest of this year, in part for the reasons that we've mentioned. We have the insecurity of a whole series of economic issues that we still have to confront. We have the insecurity of the post-war environment in Iraq and in the Middle East. We still have the terrorist insecurity, and we have now this threat of SARS, which is yet another concern that Americans have about their safety and security.
This new disease coming out of Hong Kong and China and now spreading.
Yes, but I think there's another point here about innovation, and that is not so much the economic innovation of new technologies, and I agree with the points that have been made. But I think if there is to be a silver lining here, and it's a long shot, but it's not an impossible one, and that is wars shake things up and you get real geopolitical change. The United States had one of its most dynamic periods of political and social reform during the Civil War. A lot of the innovations that we know today came from the Civil War period because it shook things up. It created a more fluid situation. Germany, after World War II, made a lot of major economic innovations that it would not have made prior to the war.
Robert Hormuz, I want to be sure I understand what you're saying then. You're way up in Goldman Sachs. When you rub elbows with the guys at the club or in the Hamptons, is there a sense, business-wise, that this war then is a positive or a negative?
Oh, I think generally there are a lot of concerns about this war. I'd hate to put war in a positive sense and that it is a desirable thing. But looking at it historically, there have been a lot of changes in countries that have been involved in war because it makes things fluid. And one of the concerns that many people have is that the countries of the Arab Middle East have had economic difficulties for a long time. They've been falling behind other emerging countries in East Asia, for instance, and elsewhere. And if there's some hope, some perhaps silver lining to an otherwise dark cloud, it's that you might get changes in Iraq and changes in the area which would enable the middle classes of Iraq, which are very productive people and they're very educated people there, to break out of this statist mode, this authoritarian mode, and perform better economically and have a better life politically, whether it's a democracy or not, who knows. But sometimes in wars, funny things happen, and you could get a period of very positive change. I think the odds are not greatly in favor of it, but it's not an impossibility either, and that would improve the economics, at least in that part of the world, and that could be very helpful over the longer term. It could bring them into the global economy, much as some of the countries of Eastern Europe and the former communist world were brought into the global economy a decade ago. It's a possibility.
Robert Hormuz, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Robert Hormuz is vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International. We're here with Michael Mandel and Stefan Richter talking about war and business, the impact on American companies abroad and the economy all over. You can join the conversation. Would you like to be an American traveling for business tonight in Indonesia, in the Middle East, in Russia, in France? Is the world still safe, still welcoming for American enterprise? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about war and business, the impact on American companies abroad and the economy all over. My guests tonight are Michael Mandel, chief economist for Businessweek magazine and author of the cover story in the upcoming issue, How War Will Reshape the Economy, and Stefan Richter, joining us from Washington tonight, publisher of The Globalist, an online magazine about the global economy. You can join the conversation as well. Do you see the economy coming up roses on the other side of war? Or do global resentment and insecurity cut into global innovation and growth? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Ben is calling. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Hey, I just have a thought. I've been in the trenches of globalization the last 15 years or so, helping companies take products from the U.S. into Asia and Europe. And it seems to me that business, the business-to-business commerce can't really be that affected because companies buy products in order to increase their own competitiveness, and I don't see the companies making decisions based on politics.
And what about trade relationships, though, Ben? Are you concerned that the anger we've seen expressed in the UN and politically could translate into less welcoming quotas and tariffs and trade in general?
Yes, a little bit, but I still think that that things are based on expediency.
So the invisible hand is going to make business to business all right.
Yeah, that's what I think. And I think the same thing is true more or less with consumers. And I believe that, short term, there can be, that people might be less at ease buying a product. But ultimately, if the product is what they need, it's at the right price, that's ultimately what people make decisions on as well.
So this is your lifeblood, and you're not worried about it, Ben.
Well, there's one area that I'm worried about, and that is that for the last decade or so, it's been very exciting, whether you're in Brazil or in China or in Poland, to be involved with an American company. So what I see as being affected is more of the sales channels and the level of excitement, the people who are actually in these countries working for a subsidiary or working in the sales channel. It's a less exciting time to be involved with American products and selling American products.
We've got it. Ben, thank you for your call. Let me put that to Stefan Richter. Stefan, you hear the fear in Ben's voice that it's just not going to have the same glamour, the same luster that it's had for the past couple of decades. Can you see that translating into real business problems for Americans?
Eventually, yes, but it even starts a little bit earlier. The key question is, do we feel good enough in looking at the future about buying anything at all, whether from an American company or any company? Keynes talked about the animal spirits, and while Ben is right to say that, the decision, do I buy from a foreign company or not, is really not closely related to the war. The key question is, do I feel confident enough about the future to consume as a consumer or to buy and invest as a business at all? And I think there's some real question with the uncertainty that we talked about earlier. In terms of the excitement about U.S. companies, I think that's really true. You also talked about the global brands and the possibly negative spillover. That's something that's going to be very difficult to measure. But it used to be that the U.S. were really, U.S. companies, U.S. brands were really the cool thing. Mm-hmm. But that was at a time when the United States, through its government, did not act in a manner that by 80 to 90% around the people of the world is now considered imperious. And we're not just talking, Muslim countries, the Arab street. We're talking strong allies, long-standing allies, South Korea, Germany, almost docile nations for a long time.
And the proof is in the pudding here. Front page of the Wall Street Journal today, American-based multinational brands ducking for cover like crazy, trying to cover up the stars and stripes. Michael Mandel, do you see that as a real drag?
No. Well, look, I have to tell you, I'm going to go back to the original question. One thing that we haven't talked about here is the movement of people, as it was alluded to. Both the foreigners coming into the U.S. and U.S. going abroad, students, scholars, ideas, and we're already seeing that slowing down. And it's not just on the other side; it's on this side of the Atlantic too. The U.S. is making it much harder for people coming to the U.S. to get visas.
Foreign students, people who want to work here, the whole works.
Scholars, workers, the whole process has been slowed down.
We've had the cream of the crop for a long time now.
Absolutely.
Are you saying we're at risk of losing that?
Exactly. We're doing this for the purposes of security. So forget the boycotts overseas, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Those are marginal. The things that we're doing at this point here are the things that are going to have the most effect on growth. And we're doing it in the name of security. And I think you have to sort of understand that
– closing doors, closing off the kind of inflow of brain power.
Yes. And what you want to think about both the boycotts and also the visa stuff, they're all aspects. When you're scared of the outside, what do? You close your windows. You close your doors. And so that's what people are doing. And that's what ends up slowing up growth. And I want to just sort of say one more thing here, and it goes to what Bob Hormat said. which is that there are opportunities created, but the people who believe in growth at this point are going to have to make their case very strongly. It's not like the 1990s where everybody said, oh, growth, this is terrific, let's go with it.
It's natural.
Right now, the movement is with security, and the people that believe in growth, whether it's businesses or other people, are going to have to make their case much more clearly because that's what's needed.
Stefan Richter, do you think the war, I keep coming back to this, has the war improved then, this environment, by, as the Bush administration would probably portray it, saying we've gone out and we've done an important thing to beat back the forces of chaos, or has it raised the tension level, the sourness, the concern over security to a new level?
I think it is going to be the latter, because the world community stood with the United States and still stands with the United States in the war on terrorism, which is not the focus of the Iraq issue, despite the best efforts of the administration. Even the U.S. intelligence agencies never were ready to support the president on the connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. That's what would have rooted out the real insecurity factor, and that's not what we're spending the money on. That's not what we're spending our time on. So that's a real problem.
So you don't see it helping there. I want to get another call here. Syed's calling. Welcome, Syed. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Thank
you
for
taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What's on your mind, Syed?
Well, I'd like to mention a point which maybe your guests can elaborate on more. I come from the Middle East myself in the Persian Gulf,
mm-hmm.
and your guests from both the publications may be aware of the place called Dubai in
of
the
course.
Middle East.
Sure, Dubai, of course, yep.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why Dubai has grown so significantly over the past 30 years is because the government, the local government over there, and the federal government has pumped in a lot of money, and they have created opportunities for people to come in and invest. And they have created security in the sense that it's quite a secure place.
So what's the problem?
And I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that if the government does not channel their policies in the right way, in the right manner, then people stop investing or take a few steps back and say, you know, is this the best time for me to invest my money?
Syed, you're from the region. Do you think the war in Iraq is going to make the Middle East and by extension the world a more secure, happy place for commerce?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that people eventually, when the emotions go down, they will come back to their senses and say, you know what, XYZ Inc. in Boston, Massachusetts is the best place to buy this product from.
So you see Adam Smith still calling the shots at some level. Syed, thanks for your call. Michael Mandel, at some basic level, what you're raising here, and I'm not even sure how war-linked it is simply the picture of a world less secure, more conservative, more bound up in security issues, less open to the kind of free-flowing innovation and capital flow that is what we've always thought of as making economies sing. That's a disturbing vision.
What has to happen is that the people who believe in the growth, the people who believe in the economic future, are going to have to make their case more aggressively, because security concerns are closer to the top of people's minds.
But can you talk these concerns away?
Well, what you can do, remember what we're talking about, is you're talking about two different visions of the world. And yes, you can. What happens is you have to put in, you have, there's certain things that you have to do to make yourself feel more secure. And then beyond that, you want to sort of hold on, though, to the economic vision that, yes, there is a future, yes, growth is good, and that we can open up the doors in a lot of different ways and still be safe. This is we're not talking about something easy. This is a very, very complicated and tough period that we're going through. And frankly, in the U.S., it's going to get more complicated and more tough because we have a lot of unemployment and we're feeling a lot of economic insecurity as well. But this is the period where we're sort of saying, look, what we want to do for our kids is not just make them secure on the physical security level, but also on the economic security as well. And that's those are two very different propositions.
Stefan Richter, we've just got a minute left, but your view looking forward, coming out of this war, where does your needle lie on the optimism, pessimism scale, economically speaking?
It's gyrating all around. I think the best thing that we can do is to stick with the things that have worked in the past. The essence of American economic history and the reason for its spellbinding success has always been that there was open immigration. We see problems these days, not just for young Middle Easterners, but people from India and all over. This has tremendous spillover effects because we're losing our ambassadors of goodwill, people that then go back to radiate the message, not just about the United States, of course, but about that the market model can work. Mm-hmm. And I think my reason for pessimism is that the government in Washington that has always led the global economy with a strong and unrelenting focus on focusing on the global economy and on growth, that's a message we have not really heard in any credible manner, if at all, out of the Bush administration for the past 2 years. And I think we're only beginning to reap the negative seeds of that, and that's why I'm rather pessimistic.
Well, we've got events here and inclinations, and they all have a price. Stefan Richter, thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Good to be with you.
Stefan Richter is publisher of The Globalist, an online magazine about the global economy. And Michael Mandel, a privilege to have you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Very glad to be here.
Michael Mandel is chief economist for Businessweek magazine. His cover story in the upcoming issue is How War Will Reshape the Economy. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, analysis of military developments in the war in Iraq. This is On Point. We end this hour with a step-back military assessment of the war this week. Tad Olstrom is a retired lieutenant general with the U.S. Air Force and now director of the National Security Studies Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening, General Olstrom.
Good morning, Tom. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. So you have watched, along with the rest of us, as emotions and expectations were whipsawed all over this week. Now the troops are there, reportedly having secured the airport just 12 miles from the center of Baghdad, renamed it from Saddam International to Baghdad International. How are you feeling about the progress of the war now, General Olstrom?
Well, you know, we began this week with a real pause, I think, with little movement of those forward elements, and we had the squabble going on at the Pentagon with the media, including armchair generals, over how heavy the combat force should have been. And as you mentioned, we were on an emotional yo-yo, certainly on the downswing at the beginning of the week. But out of sight, I think, was the very effective and concentrated destruction of those fielded Iraqi units and the probing that was going on by our coalition recon units. On Wednesday, we saw the declaration by CENTCOM's General Brooks saying the dagger is pointed at the heart of the regime.
When you say recon units, you mean forward units that are out ahead of the main force?
Exactly.
Doing what?
They obviously are looking for weaknesses, looking at the fielded forces of the Iraqis, where the weaknesses are, which directions we want to go in some cases to either bypass or the weakness within the unit that we can go through.
And the Air Force seems to have played an absolutely critical role in clearing the way for the ground forces this week.
The air elements, and I would not say that's just the Air Force. Obviously,
that's right. Army Airborne as well.
Army Airborne, Marines, a tremendous piece, including the artillery. It was all part of softening, if you would, and attriting those forward-deployed units.
The question that rises in many minds now is, as we look at urban Baghdad, can air support be as effective, or do things really migrate now to ground level?
Oh, it will be just as important, maybe not in exactly the same way, maybe more selective, but there's no doubt that it will be key at every step of the way.
So how much longer?
There's no way to tell. There absolutely is no way to tell. Not enough signs are there yet. We are obviously in position. With the airport, with the Marines on the southeast, we certainly are at the point now where we are controlling the moves, and the moves will be ours, and the pace will be ours.
Well, it feels a lot more comfortable, I'm sure, in the command center there right now than it did a week ago. Tad Olstrom, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Tad Olstrom is retired lieutenant general with the U.S. Air Force and director of the National Security Studies Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Mata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.